Reduce, reuse, recycle. The way we repeat the phrase, B.J. Lederman does our theme music. But a new word might be added to this litany. The founder of a nonprofit in North Carolina wants us to reuse all durable packaging, from shoeboxes to yogurt containers. Teresa Carey reports from Durham.
Crystal Dreisbach rummages through a recycling bin set on the curb by one of her neighbors. For most people, the items in the bin are just trash. Not for Dreisbach. These are signs of opportunity.
This is a beautiful one. Here we've got glass beer bottles, we've got aluminum cans, and we've got a couple of, fellow fisher person, some Nightcrawler containers made of plastic.
Dreisbach is a self-proclaimed trash junkie. She's made it her personal goal to put an end to single-use packaging, which she calls the take-and-trash economy.
Right now, we have sort of the status quo. We extract materials from the earth, and then we make things with them, and then we use them, and then we generally throw them away.
So in 2010, she zeroed in on reusing takeout containers. Other zero-waste services have popped up around the country, like Portland's GoBox or Useful, a coffee cup collective in Boston. Dreisbach's own project, called Green to Go, provides durable takeout containers to Durham restaurants. Customers take their meal home in a reusable box. Then they simply drop the dirty box into a collection bin. Like the classic milkman model, Green to Go will collect, wash, sanitize, and redistribute the containers so restaurants can use them repeatedly. They even pick them up by bicycle to keep their carbon footprint low. At Part and Parcel, Tea Land Store, Land packs goods in reusable glass jars, stocked and washed by Green to Go.
Glass is amazing. It doesn't retain odors. It can hold anything. You can see what's inside of it. There's just so many benefits to it, but it's heavy, and it doesn't often get recycled.
From pasta to hand soap, everything in the store is package-free. And Land says doing away with disposable bags and containers is worth the extra effort.
This is replicable. Other businesses can do this. It will ultimately save them money to do it.
So far, 29 businesses in Durham, including restaurants, schools, and product producers, are packaging goods in these reusable containers. There are over 800 active users who pay a small membership fee. Altogether, Dreisbach says they have stopped more than 20,000 disposable containers from ending up in a landfill.
Green to Go, really, it's an experiment in which we demonstrate possibility of a different way of doing things. So we think to ourselves, what if durable, reusable packaging could be used again and again?
Dreisbach wants to harness the existing recycling infrastructure to create a new system, a local economy where durable goods circulate endlessly between consumers and companies. Her proposal is called recirculation. Last year, she partnered with the City of Durham Solid Waste Management and Sunoco Recycling for a pilot demonstration. The containers are put in recycling bins and recovered. Wayne Fenton, Durham's Assistant Solid Waste Manager, helped facilitate the project. He says, recirculation has a greater potential to work if it involves local manufacturers only, circulating the reusable goods within the community.
I'll just say that there are hurdles to be overcome to be able to make it work. If enough consumers demanded it, then they would figure it out. But until the consumers demand it, it's easy to just keep doing what you've been doing all along.
Dreisbach's idea comes with renewed interest in reusables. But in order for it to work, the system has to be economical. Deborah Gallagher, a professor of resource and environmental policy at Duke University, led a group of business students in a feasibility study of the recirculation project.
The biggest issue was, how do you get these companies to increase the durability of their packaging so that the packaging actually, stands up to being recollected?
Despite the challenges, Gallagher says it's possible. And Dreisbach is moving forward with the next demonstration, one which involves the participation of 30 more businesses.
We know for a fact, based on 4 years of operating Green to Go, that once you put in the infrastructure and supply chain to make reuse possible, you can reuse anything.
Recirculation could combine the waste-free aspect of the milkman model, but with the convenience of disposables we've grown accustomed to. For NPR News, I'm Teresa Carey in Durham, North Carolina.
Reduce, reuse, recycle. The way we repeat the phrase, B.J. Lederman is our theme music. But a new word might be added to this litany. The founder of a nonprofit in North Carolina wants us to reuse all durable packaging, from shoeboxes to yogurt containers. Teresa Carey reports from Durham.
Crystal Dreisbach rummages through a recycling bin set on the curb by one of her neighbors. For most people, the items in the bin are just trash. Not for Dreisbach. These are signs of opportunity.
This is a beautiful one. Here we've got glass beer bottles, we've got aluminum cans, and we've got a couple of, fellow fisher person. Some Nightcrawler containers made of plastic.
Dreisbach is a self-proclaimed trash junkie. She's made it her personal goal to put an end to single-use packaging, which she calls the take-and-trash economy.
Right now we have sort of the status quo. We extract materials from the earth, and then we make things with them, and then we use them, and then we generally throw them away.
So in 2010, she zeroed in on reusing takeout containers. Other zero-waste services have popped up around the country, like Portland's GoBox or Useful, a coffee cup collective in Boston. Dreisbach's own project, called Green to Go, provides durable takeout containers to Durham restaurants. Customers take their meal home in a reusable box. Then they simply drop the dirty box into a collection bin. Like the classic milkman model, Green to Go will collect, wash, sanitize, and redistribute the containers so restaurants can use them repeatedly. They even pick them up by bicycle to keep their carbon footprint low. At Part and Parcel, T. Land's store, Land packs goods in reusable glass jars, stocked and washed by Green to Go.
Glass is amazing. It doesn't retain odors. It can hold anything. You can see what's inside of it. There's just so many benefits to it, but it's heavy and it doesn't often get recycled.
From pasta to hand soap, everything in the store is package free. And Land says doing away with disposable bags and containers is worth the extra effort.
This is replicable. Other businesses can do this. It will ultimately save them money to do it.
So far, 29 businesses in Durham, including restaurants, schools, and product producers, are packaging goods in these reusable containers. There are over 800 active users who pay a small membership fee. Altogether, Dreisbach says they have stopped more than 20,000 disposable containers from ending up in a landfill.
Green to Go, really, it's an experiment in which we demonstrate possibility of a different way of doing things. So we think to ourselves, what if durable, reusable packaging could be used again and again?
Dreisbach wants to harness the existing recycling infrastructure to create a new system, a local economy where durable goods circulate endlessly between consumers and companies. Her proposal is called recirculation. Last year, she partnered with the City of Durham Solid Waste Management and Sunoco Recycling for a pilot demonstration. The containers are put in recycling bins and recovered. Wayne Fenton, Durham's assistant solid waste manager, helped facilitate the project. He says recirculation has a greater potential to work if it involves local manufacturers only, circulating the reusable goods within the community.
I'll just say that there are hurdles to be overcome to be able to make it work. If enough consumers demanded it, then they would figure it out. But until the consumers demand it, it's easy to just keep doing what you've been doing all along.
Dreisbach's idea comes with renewed interest in reusables, but in order for it to work, the system has to be economical. Deborah Gallagher, a professor of resource and environmental policy at Duke University, led a group of business students in a feasibility study of the recirculation project.
The biggest issue was, how do you get these companies to increase the durability of their packaging so that the packaging actually, stands up to being recollected?
Despite the challenges, Gallagher says it's possible, and Dreisbach is moving forward with the next demonstration, one which involves the participation of 30 more businesses.
We know for a fact, based on 4 years of operating Green to Go, that once you put in the infrastructure and supply chain to make reuse possible, you can reuse anything.
Recirculation could combine the waste-free aspect of the milkman model, but with the convenience of disposables we've grown accustomed to. For NPR News, I'm Teresa Carey in Durham, North Carolina.
Reduce, reuse, recycle. The way we repeat the phrase, B.J. Lederman is our theme music. But a new word might be added to this litany. The founder of a nonprofit in North Carolina wants us to reuse all durable packaging, from shoeboxes to yogurt containers, to Risa Carey reports from Durham.
Crystal Dreisbach rummages through a recycling bin set on the curb by one of her neighbors. For most people, the items in the bin are just trash. Oh, okay. Not for Dreisbach. These are signs of opportunity.
This is a beautiful one. Here we've got glass beer bottles, we've got aluminum cans, and we've got a couple of, fellow fisher person. Some Nightcrawler containers made of plastic.
Dreisbach is a self-proclaimed trash junkie. She's made it her personal goal to put an end to single-use packaging, which she calls the take-and-trash economy.
Right now, we have sort of the status quo. We extract materials from the earth, and then we make things with them, and then we use them, and then we generally throw them away.
So in 2010, she zeroed in on reusing takeout containers. Other zero-waste services have popped up around the country, like Portland's GoBox or Useful, a coffee cup collective in Boston. Dreisbach's own project, called Green to Go, provides durable takeout containers to Durham restaurants. Customers take their meal home in a reusable box. Then they simply drop the dirty box into a collection bin. Like the classic milkman model, Green to Go will collect, wash, sanitize, and redistribute the containers so restaurants can use them repeatedly. They even pick them up by bicycle to keep their carbon footprint low. At Part and Parcel, T. Land Store, Land packs goods in reusable glass jars, stocked and washed by Green to Go.
Glass is amazing. It doesn't retain odors. It can hold anything. You can see what's inside of it. There's just so many benefits to it, but it's heavy, and it doesn't often get recycled.
From pasta to hand soap, everything in the store is package-free. And Land says doing away with disposable bags and containers is worth the extra effort.
This is replicable. Other businesses can do this. It will ultimately save them money to do it.
So far, 29 businesses in Durham, including restaurants, schools, and product producers, are packaging goods in these reusable containers. There are over 800 active users who pay a small membership fee. Altogether, Dreisbach says they have stopped more than 20,000 disposable containers from ending up in a landfill.
Green to Go, really, it's an experiment in which we demonstrate possibility of a different way of doing things. So we think to ourselves, what if durable, reusable packaging could be used again and again?
Dreisbach wants to harness the existing recycling infrastructure to create a new system, a local economy where durable goods circulate endlessly between consumers and companies. Her proposal is called recirculation. Last year, she partnered with the City of Durham Solid Waste Management and Sunoco Recycling for a pilot demonstration. The containers are put in recycling bins and recovered. Wayne Fenton, Durham's Assistant Solid Waste Manager, helped facilitate the project. He says recirculation has a greater potential to work if it involves local manufacturers only, circulating the reusable goods within the community.
I'll just say that there are hurdles to be overcome to be able to make it work. If enough consumers demanded it, then they would figure it out. But until the consumers demand it, it's easy to just keep doing what you've been doing all along.
Dreisbach's idea comes with renewed interest in reusables. But in order for it to work, the system has to be economical. Deborah Gallagher, a professor of resource and environmental policy at Duke University, led a group of business students in a feasibility study of the recirculation project.
The biggest issue was, how do you get these companies to increase the durability of their packaging so that the packaging actually, you know, stands up to being recollected?
Despite the challenges, Gallagher says it's possible. And Dreisbach is moving forward with the next demonstration, one which involves the participation of 30 more businesses.
We know for a fact, based on 4 years of operating Green to Go, that once you put in the infrastructure and supply chain to make reuse possible, you can reuse anything.
Recirculation could combine the waste-free aspect of the milkman model, but with the convenience of disposables we've grown accustomed to. For NPR News, I'm Teresa Carey in Durham, North Carolina.
In 1984, Guy Laliberté co-founded Cirque du Soleil. Soon Cirque was bringing in revenues that incumbents like Ringling Brothers had taken more than a century to attain, even though the circus business was in long-term decline. How did Cirque thrive in such a dismal environment? The answer can be found in the theory that the business universe consists of two kinds of markets, red oceans and blue oceans, a concept pioneered by INSEAD professors W. Chan Kim and René Beauborn. Red oceans represent existing industries and markets, where industry boundaries and the rules of competition are well defined. Companies strive to outperform rivals and grab a bigger share of existing demand. As the space gets crowded, fierce competition turns the water bloody. Competitive or market competing strategy is about how to occupy red oceans. By contrast, blue ocean or market creating strategy is about how to create and capture unknown markets where demand is created rather than fought over. In some cases, this spawns entirely new industries. But most blue oceans emerge when a company alters the boundaries of an existing industry, as when Cirque du Soleil blurred the line between circus and theatre. Cirque made the acts more artistic and sophisticated, attracting a whole new group of customers, adults who were prepared to pay premium ticket prices as they would for the theatre or the opera. Cirque also eliminated several elements of the traditional circus like costly animal acts and star performers. Cirque invented a new and profitable market space without making the typical trade-off between value and cost. Cirque pursued both differentiation and low cost in what Kim and Mauborn call value innovation. The simultaneous pursuit of value and cost is the logic of Blue Ocean strategy. Based on their study of more than 30 industries, companies that can create blue oceans usually reap the benefits for 10 to 15 years because they are hard for rivals to copy. To realize blue ocean potential like Cirque did, companies should chart a strategic course past traditional industry boundaries to create new market space. In 1984, Guy Laliberté co-founded Cirque du Soleil. Soon Cirque was bringing in revenues that incumbents like Ringling Brothers had taken more than a century to attain, even though the circus business was in long-term decline. How did Cirque thrive in such a dismal environment? The answer can be found in the theory that the business universe consists of two kinds of markets, red oceans and blue oceans, a concept pioneered by INSEAD professors W. Chan Kim and René Beauborn. Red oceans represent existing industries and markets, where industry boundaries and the rules of competition are well defined. Companies strive to outperform rivals and grab a bigger share of existing demand. As the space gets crowded, fierce competition turns the water bloody. Competitive or market competing strategy is about how to occupy red oceans. By contrast, blue ocean or market creating strategy is about how to create and capture unknown markets where demand is created rather than fought over. In some cases, this spawns entirely new industries. But most blue oceans emerge when a company alters the boundaries of an existing industry, as when Cirque du Soleil blurred the line between circus and theatre. Cirque made the acts more artistic and sophisticated, attracting a whole new group of customers, adults who were prepared to pay premium ticket prices as they would for the theatre or the opera. Cirque also eliminated several elements of the traditional circus like costly animal acts and star performers. Cirque invented a new and profitable market space without making the typical trade-off between value and cost. Cirque pursued both differentiation and low cost in what Kim and Mauborn call value innovation. The simultaneous pursuit of value and cost is the logic of Blue Ocean strategy. Based on their study of more than 30 industries, companies that can create blue oceans usually reap the benefits for 10 to 15 years because they are hard for rivals to copy. To realize blue ocean potential like Cirque did, companies should chart a strategic course past traditional industry boundaries to create new market space. In 1984, Guy Laliberté co-founded Cirque du Soleil. Soon, Cirque was bringing in revenues that incumbents like Ringling Brothers had taken more than a century to attain, even though the circus business was in long-term decline. How did Cirque thrive in such a dismal environment? The answer can be found in the theory that the business universe consists of two kinds of markets, red oceans and blue oceans, a concept pioneered by INSEAD professors W. Chan Kim and René Beauborn. Red oceans represent existing industries and markets, where industry boundaries and the rules of competition are well defined. Companies strive to outperform rivals and grab a bigger share of existing demand. As the space gets crowded, fierce competition turns the water bloody. Competitive or market competing strategy is about how to occupy red oceans. By contrast, blue ocean or market creating strategy is about how to create and capture unknown markets where demand is created rather than fought over. In some cases, this spawns entirely new industries. But most blue oceans emerge when a company alters the boundaries of an existing industry, as when Cirque du Soleil blurred the line between circus and theatre. Cirque made the acts more artistic and sophisticated, attracting a whole new group of customers, adults who were prepared to pay premium ticket prices as they would for the theatre or the opera. Cirque also eliminated several elements of the traditional circus like costly animal acts and star performers. Cirque invented a new and profitable market space without making the typical trade-off between value and cost. Cirque pursued both differentiation and low cost in what Kim and Beauborn call value innovation. The simultaneous pursuit of value and cost is the logic of Blue Ocean strategy. Based on their study of more than 30 industries, companies that can create blue oceans usually reap the benefits for 10 to 15 years because they are hard for rivals to copy. To realize blue ocean potential like Cirque did, companies should chart a strategic course past traditional industry boundaries to create new market space.
We cross bridges all the time without thinking about it, over highways, lakes, and rivers. However, we might think twice before crossing a rope bridge on foot or a tall suspension bridge over a massive canyon. So where are the deadliest bridges in the world? Puente de Ojuelo Bridge, Mexico. Built in the 19th century during Mexico's prime mining days, the Puente de Ojuelo Bridge used to be used for transporting goods, but is now a tourist attraction. It's perfect for the traveler that enjoys swaying bridges and wide, unprotected spaces between planks to see the canyon below. Gasa Bridge, Nepal. If you're really looking for an unsteady bridge with the high potential of it falling underneath your feet, look no further than the Gasa Suspension Bridge in Nepal. In order to stop congestion, they built the bridge to transport livestock. So, if it breaks, you'll get to share the experience with some animals. Langkawi Sky Bridge, Kedah, Malaysia. Langkawi Sky Bridge is one of the most unusual bridges in the world, purposely curving around the mountain to give visitors unique perspectives. Needless to say, standing on a 130-meter-high curved bridge that only uses one long pylon for support doesn't build confidence. Iyakazurabashi Bridge, Japan. No one knows who built the Iyakazurabashi Bridge or the other sister bridges just like it, but some people believe they were built long ago by a people that were trying to escape the Genji clan. They were built for the specific purpose to easily cut them down so their enemies couldn't cross. Not exactly a ringing endorsement for their structurally sound engineering. Taman Negara Canopy Walkway, Malaysia. While perhaps more structurally sound than walking on vines, the Taman Negara Canopy Walkway is 45 meters high and 510 meters long, with a very narrow passage that only fits one person at a time. 7 Mile Bridge, Florida. The 7 Mile Bridge is a 6.765-mile bridge that spans over the Atlantic Ocean in the Florida Keys. So, if you hate bridges and are terrified of the ocean, this bridge is not for you. Muswell-Tsurabashi Bridge, Japan. Built back in the 1950s, the Muswell-Tsurabashi Bridge is held up only by wire and a few wood planks with a narrow passage across. You'd have to either be brave or insane to cross this bridge. The Monkey Bridges of Vietnam. Popular in the Mekong Delta and a symbol of Vietnam, the Monkey Bridge is primarily bamboo tied together with only one bamboo beam crossing over the water. Those not used to walking on bamboo would find these very dangerous and difficult to cross. Quechuachaco Bridge, Peru. Crossing the Apurimac River Canyon, the Quechuachaco Bridge is of an ancient Inca design, built from 6 strands of long grass into cables and secured to the trunks of eucalyptus trees. However, the fibers deteriorate rapidly, and it must be rebuilt every year. Kuandinsky Bridge of Kuanda, Russia. The Kuandinsky Bridge is a narrow and old metal bridge covered in slippery wooden planks with no side railing. One wrong move, and your car would tumble into the icy water below. Storsaisuna Bridge, Norway. Looking like a bridge leading to nowhere, the Storsaisuna Bridge in Norway looks a lot like a roller coaster, seemingly dropping off below instead of providing safe passage across. Husseini Hanging Bridge, Pakistan. In the mountainous region of northern Pakistan, the Husseini Hanging Bridge helps travelers cross the Borit Lake. However, it's poorly maintained and considerably long, with only a couple of cables and loose wooden planks to help you cross. With strong winds rocking the bridge and an older, broken bridge nearby, you've got to have nerves of steel to cross. We cross bridges all the time without thinking about it, over highways, lakes, and rivers. However, we might think twice before crossing a rope bridge on foot or a tall suspension bridge over a massive canyon. So where are the deadliest bridges in the world? Puente de Ojuelo Bridge, Mexico. Built in the 19th century during Mexico's prime mining days, the Puente de Ojuelo Bridge used to be used for transporting goods, but is now a tourist attraction. It's perfect for the traveler that enjoys swaying bridges and wide, unprotected spaces between planks to see the canyon below. Gasa Bridge, Nepal. If you're really looking for an unsteady bridge with the high potential of it falling underneath your feet, look no further than the Gasa Suspension Bridge in Nepal. In order to stop congestion, they built the bridge to transport livestock. So, if it breaks, you'll get to share the experience with some animals. Langkawi Sky Bridge, Kedah, Malaysia. Langkawi Sky Bridge is one of the most unusual bridges in the world, purposely curving around the mountain to give visitors unique perspectives. Needless to say, standing on a 130-meter-high curved bridge that only uses one long pylon for support doesn't build confidence. Iyakazurabashi Bridge, Japan. No one knows who built the Iyakazurabashi Bridge or the other sister bridges just like it, but some people believe they were built long ago by a people that were trying to escape the Genji clan. They were built for the specific purpose to easily cut them down so their enemies couldn't cross. Not exactly a ringing endorsement for their structurally sound engineering. Taman Negara Canopy Walkway, Malaysia. While perhaps more structurally sound than walking on vines, the Taman Negara Canopy Walkway is 45 meters high and 510 meters long, with a very narrow passage that only fits one person at a time. 7 Mile Bridge, Florida. The 7 Mile Bridge is a 6.765-mile bridge that spans over the Atlantic Ocean in the Florida Keys. So, if you hate bridges and are terrified of the ocean, this bridge is not for you. Musuo-Tsurabashi Bridge, Japan. Built back in the 1950s, the Musuo-Tsurabashi Bridge is held up only by wire and a few wood planks with a narrow passage across. You'd have to either be brave or insane to cross this bridge. The Monkey Bridges of Vietnam. Popular in the Mekong Delta and a symbol of Vietnam, the Monkey Bridge is primarily bamboo tied together with only one bamboo beam crossing over the water. Those not used to walking on bamboo would find these very dangerous and difficult to cross. Quechuachaca Bridge, Peru. Crossing the Apurimac River Canyon, the Quechuachaca Bridge is of an ancient Inca design, built from 6 strands of long grass into cables and secured to the trunks of eucalyptus trees. However, the fibers deteriorate rapidly, and it must be rebuilt every year. Kuandinsky Bridge of Kuanda, Russia. The Kuandinsky Bridge is a narrow and old metal bridge covered in slippery wooden planks with no side railing. One wrong move, and your car would tumble into the icy water below. Storsaisuna Bridge, Norway. Looking like a bridge leading to nowhere, the Storsaisuna Bridge in Norway looks a lot like a roller coaster, seemingly dropping off below instead of providing safe passage across. Husseini Hanging Bridge, Pakistan. In the mountainous region of northern Pakistan, the Husseini Hanging Bridge helps travelers cross the Borit Lake. However, it's poorly maintained and considerably long, with only a couple of cables and loose wooden planks to help you cross. With strong winds rocking the bridge and an older, broken bridge nearby, you've got to have nerves of steel to cross. We cross bridges all the time without thinking about it, over highways, lakes, and rivers. However, we might think twice before crossing a rope bridge on foot or a tall suspension bridge over a massive canyon. So where are the deadliest bridges in the world? Puente de Ojuelo Bridge, Mexico. Built in the 19th century during Mexico's prime mining days, the Puente de Ojuelo Bridge used to be used for transporting goods, but is now a tourist attraction. It's perfect for the traveler that enjoys swaying bridges and wide, unprotected spaces between planks to see the canyon below. Gasa Bridge, Nepal. If you're really looking for an unsteady bridge with the high potential of it falling underneath your feet, look no further than the Gasa Suspension Bridge in Nepal. In order to stop congestion, they built the bridge to transport livestock. So, if it breaks, you'll get to share the experience with some animals. Langkawi Sky Bridge, Kedah, Malaysia. Langkawi Sky Bridge is one of the most unusual bridges in the world, purposely curving around the mountain to give visitors unique perspectives. Needless to say, standing on a 130-meter-high curved bridge that only uses one long pylon for support doesn't build confidence. Iyakazurabashi Bridge, Japan. No one knows who built the Iyakazurabashi Bridge or the other sister bridges just like it, but some people believe they were built long ago by a people that were trying to escape the Genji clan. They were built for the specific purpose to easily cut them down so their enemies couldn't cross. Not exactly a ringing endorsement for their structurally sound engineering. Taman Negara Canopy Walkway, Malaysia. While perhaps more structurally sound than walking on vines, the Taman Negara Canopy Walkway is 45 meters high and 510 meters long, with a very narrow passage that only fits one person at a time. 7 Mile Bridge, Florida. The 7 Mile Bridge is a 6.765-mile bridge that spans over the Atlantic Ocean in the Florida Keys. So, if you hate bridges and are terrified of the ocean, this bridge is not for you. Musuo-Tsurubashi Bridge, Japan. Built back in the 1950s, the Musuo-Tsurubashi Bridge is held up only by wire and a few wood planks with a narrow passage across. You'd have to either be brave or insane to cross this bridge. The Monkey Bridges of Vietnam. Popular in the Mekong Delta and a symbol of Vietnam, the Monkey Bridge is primarily bamboo tied together with only one bamboo beam crossing over the water. Those not used to walking on bamboo would find these very dangerous and difficult to cross. Quechuachaca Bridge, Peru. Crossing the Apurimac River Canyon, the Quechuachaca Bridge is of an ancient Inca design, built from 6 strands of long grass into cables and secured to the trunks of eucalyptus trees. However, the fibers deteriorate rapidly, and it must be rebuilt every year. Kuandinsky Bridge of Kuanda, Russia. The Kuandinsky Bridge is a narrow and old metal bridge covered in slippery wooden planks with no side railing. One wrong move, and your car would tumble into the icy water below. Storsaisuna Bridge, Norway. Looking like a bridge leading to nowhere, the Storsaisunda Bridge in Norway looks a lot like a roller coaster, seemingly dropping off below instead of providing safe passage across. Husseini Hanging Bridge, Pakistan. In the mountainous region of northern Pakistan, the Husseini Hanging Bridge helps travelers cross the Borit Lake. However, it's poorly maintained and considerably long, with only a couple of cables and loose wooden planks to help you cross. With strong winds rocking the bridge and an older, broken bridge nearby, you've got to have nerves of steel to cross.